Okay, we are going to start the last of the 13 Ikarim, but since this is the first class in Chodesh Elul, so I wanted to give a little preface to the month, and after thinking about what exactly I wanted to speak about, a few days ago, I had the chance to speak at Kever Rachel, sponsored by Evelyn Hayes in her home there, next to Kever Rachel. And what I said there really has a lot of significance, both parts of it, to a preface to the month of Elul and to Aseres Yemei Tshuva. So I'm going to repeat what I said there. I don't know how many of you were there. I was, so I'm going to hear this again, so no worse than me. But I really think that it's kedai to say over, and since most of you were not there, I'm going to take the liberty of repeating it. Hopefully this will not take the entire shiur, and we'll be able to start this 13th Iker, at least to get started on it. The topic, obviously, was Rachel Imenu and the Midos of Rachel Imenu. But as a preface, and that I think has tremendous importance and relevance to Elul, Slichos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, wanted to speak about the concept of avos and imahos, because we are going to be evoking the schus, the merit of our avos and imahos throughout this month, especially when Slicha starts, and throughout Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and we should have an idea what that is. What does that mean? What does chus avos, bris avos actually mean? And when it comes to avos and imahos, Chazal tell us, ein korin la avos ela shlosha, ve'ein korin la imahos ela arba. Who we call our avos and imahos only apply to three men and four women: Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And Bilhah and Zilpah were subordinate to Rachel and Leah. Those are the seven individuals who the term avos and imahos apply to. Now, obviously, we all have our fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers all the way back. The concept of avos and imahos is not merely that they were our progenitors, that they came before us. It's a completely different idea. And I'll prove it to you. We're going to be saying Slichos very soon. And there we're going to say the following: Zechor lanu bris avos. Remember the covenant you made with our avos. And right after that we say Zechor lanu bris rishonim. Remember for us the bris you made with the first ones. Now, if the avos weren't the first ones, who were? Now, the idea is that Rishonim means the first generation that went out of Egypt. That was the first generation of Klal Yisrael. But the avos came before the first. The avos are the foundation upon which everything else is built. They're not the first. They're before the first. They're the foundation. So what does that mean? To illustrate it, I want to explain a Rashi. The Rashi is in the beginning of Seder Vo'era, way back in Shmos. The Pasuk says the following: Moshe Rabbeinu comes to the Rabbono Shel Olam with complaints that he was sent to redeem the Jewish people, and not only wasn't he successful, but things got worse for them. So Moshe Rabbeinu comes, Loma Harioso Loma Zeh, why did you deal badly with these people? Loma Zeh Shlachtoni, why'd you send me? From the time I went to speak to Paro, in your name things got worse for them. You didn't save them. So the Rabbanu Shel Olam responds to Moshe Rabbeinu in the following way. Vayedaber Elokim el Moshe vayomre lov ani Hashem. The Rabbanu Shel Olam speaks harshly to Moshe Rabbeinu. He tells him, ani Hashem. Vo'eiro el Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov bekel Shakai. I appear to the Avos, to Avraham, Yitzchak ve'Yaakov bekel Shakai. Ushmi Hashem lo nodati lohem. I never made known to them my name Hashem, only Shakai. Rashi brings down a medrash that says the following. The Rabbanu Shel Olam said to Moshe Rabbeinu, Chaval al da'avdim v'lo mishtachin. I used to have great people. I promised them things and they never saw the fulfillment of the promise. I promised Avraham Avinu I'd give him Eretz Yisrael. And he had to spend an exorbitant amount to buy a burial plot for his wife. He never complained, never questioned me. Same thing with Yitzchak Avinu, the same thing with Yaakov Avinu. And you, Moshe Rabbeinu, the first time that I send you on a mission and it doesn't work out the way you think it's supposed to work out, you're ready to complain. Chaval al da'avdin velo mishtachas. A shame that they're lost and can't be found. Those were people who never questioned me, who never complained. Rashi, before he brings down this medrash, adds an extra word to the sentence that seems to be totally redundant and unnecessary. On the pasuk, Vo'eiro el Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov. I appear to Avraham Yitzchak ve'Yaakov. Rashi adds the words, Vo'eiro el ha'avos. I appear to the avos. Now, what is Rashi adding to that sentence? It says, Vo'eiro el Avraham el Yitzchak ve'el Yaakov. Obviously, they're the avos. I need Rashi to tell me that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are the avos. And without Rashi telling me that it's referring to the avos, I would think that it's some Avraham Schwartz or Yitzchak Ginsburg or something like that. But I have to know, no, these are the avos. Don't, in case you forgot from Sefer Bereishis, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they were the avos. Why do I need Rashi to tell me that? Rashi doesn't say an extra word. Why the necessity to point out that these are the avos? An additional question that can be asked is based on a Chassidish Maisa, which the Maisa brings a point across that seems to be a valid point. They say that the Rebbe Reb Zusha used to say, I'm not afraid if after 120 years they ask me, Zusha, how come you weren't as great as the Rambam? How come you weren't as great as the Baal Shem Tov? I'm going to tell them I'm Zusha. I didn't have the potential to be the Rambam. I didn't have the potential to be the Baal Shem Tov. You know what I'm afraid of? They're going to say to me, Zusha, how come you weren't Zusha? That scares me. How come I didn't fulfill my potential? That points out that you can't demand of any individual something that somebody else could do because maybe this person doesn't have that potential. So you can't have a complaint against somebody because they weren't somebody else. Or as Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, you have to do it with your mind and your heart and your midos, not with somebody else's. God expects from you who you are, not who somebody else is. If that's the case, then what is the complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu? Chaval al da'avdim v'lo mishtachim. It's a shame that the avos are lost and can't be found, because they were able to hear promises, and when they weren't fulfilled, not to complain and not to question, and you can. Why doesn't Moshe Rabbeinu turn around and say, what's the complaint against me? I'm not Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. I'm Moshe. So they were great people, I admit it. But they're much greater than me, so what do you have a complaint against me that I can't be like them? Right? I'm not them. But it seems that God does have a complaint against Moshe Rabbeinu. How come he wasn't like them? So it seems to contradict this concept that you can't demand from somebody what somebody else does just because somebody else did it. Beyond that, one last question. God says it's a shame that the avos are lost and can't be found. First of all, the avos are lost. I know where they are. Their bodies are in Mar Samach Pela and their neshamas are in Gan Eden. So in case the Rabbanu Shem had a problem finding them, I could tell them where they are. And it's redundant. Chaval al da'avdim, it's a shame that they're lost, v'lo mishtach, and it can't be found. Obviously, if they're lost, they can't be found, because if they could be found, they wouldn't be lost. So why the redundancy? Al da'avdin v'lo mishtachin. They're lost and can't be found. What does that mean? I was thinking of explaining it in the following way. Avos, like we said, are not just the progenitors, the ones who came first, but the avos created the foundation, the spiritual genetic gene pool of Klal Yisrael. And everything the Avos did, to a certain degree, Avram Avinu went through 10 tests, and Yitzchak Avinu the Akedah, and Yaakov Avinu, all of the things that he went through, created the spiritual potential of the Jewish people for all generations. That is, Avram Avinu brought out the Pintle Yid, that spark of Yiddishkeit that never can be extinguished in every Jew. The Sfas Emes refers to it as Magen Avram. That is the shield of Avram. It was passed on to all generations. We have it in our genes, in our blood. It's part and parcel of every Jew. And the things that the Avos were able to accomplish passed on to all their generations, including us. And we have within us the potential of the Avos. The very spiritual makeup of the Jewish people, Rachmanim, Baishanim, Gomlei Chasadim. We are merciful people. We're people who have the capacity for shame. We are the people who are Gomlei Chasadim. Where do we get that from? It's part of the nature of a Jew. Every Jew has that nature. He can suppress it. He can go against it. But it's there. It's part of the makeup of a Jew. And even a Ger who's Megayer gets a Jewish neshama that was affected by the Avos and becomes with those qualities, has those qualities. So we got from Avram Avinu that we're Gomlei Chasadim. We got from Yitzchak Avinu that we're Baishanim. We have the capacity for shame. And we got from Yaakov Avinu the fact that we're merciful. It's part of our spiritual genetic makeup. It's what we are. And therefore, it's true. You can't demand from somebody to be somebody else. But you can demand that the qualities of the Avos, which are part and parcel of every Jew, it's part of our gene makeup, the gene pool of Klal Yisrael, which was created by the Avos, that is something that goes on for generation after generation. And one of the midos of the Avos was they were able to trust God, not question Him, and not complain. And that's what the Rabbanu Shem told Moshe Rabbeinu. True. If it would just be, I appeared to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov as individuals, then you're right, Moshe Rabbeinu, I have no complaint against you that you can't be as great as those individuals. But that's why Rashi points out, Vo'era el ha'Avos, I didn't appear to them as individuals. I appeared to them as Avos, as the foundation of all that will come after. They created that spiritual foundation of every Jew. And therefore, Chaval al da'avdin, it's a shame that in you they're lost. V'lo mishtach, I can't find them in you. They're there somewhere. You have that potential. It's not that I'm complaining that you're not as great as somebody else. I'm complaining that somehow what you inherited from the Avos is lost in you and I can't find it, but it's there somewhere. And therefore I have a right to complain. You have that potential because you inherited it from the Avos. All of us inherited that potential from the Avos. That's what Rashi means. And that's why we start Shmona Esrei with the bracha of Avos, because our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and everything that we ask for and everything that we want and everything that we are stems from Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. That's who we are. First you have to know who you are before you can deal with the Rabbanu Shel Olam and ask Him for things or whatever. You have to know who you are, you have to know who he is, that's the second bracha in Shemona Esrei, and you have to know what your relationship is between you. So in order to know who we are, we have to evoke our avos. That's who we are. We are the product of great people who created the foundation and the very wherewithal that Klal Yisrael have. Those are our avos and imos. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And this is the concept of bris avos more specifically, but even zechus avos. We're going to evoke the merit of our forefathers throughout Elul, throughout Aseres Yemei Tshuva, Zechor Lanu bris avos, remember the bris, over and over and over again. We're going to ask the Rabban Hashem to remember Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Now on the surface, if the concept is protectia, you know, look, our avos did a lot of good things, and they have like a surplus in the bank, so give us a little bit of that credit. It may work like that a little bit, even though Chazal say that schus avos tamu was used up. It was, the bank account was depleted.
That's scary.
At a certain time in history. So that may not work anymore, but even if it does, it would seem to be counterproductive to mention our avos in respect to us when begging God for mercy. Why? Imagine if you have two teenagers that are caught shoplifting. Went to a store, and they come out with things in their pocket that they didn't pay for, and they're caught. And they're brought before a judge. The judge says to the first one, "Tell me a little bit about your family history. Before I sentence you for stealing, for shoplifting, let me hear a little bit about you." She says, "Well, my father was a thief. My grandfather was a horse thief. And my great-grandfather was the head of the mafia." He says, "Well, things are getting better in your family. You're only a shoplifter." He'll go easy on that person, considering what his background is. Second teenager, he says, "Tell me a little bit about your background." He says, "Well, my father was a Rav, my grandfather was a posate, and my great-grandfather was a Gadol Hador." He said, "You're a shoplifter?" Now, obviously, the second one is going to get a much stiffer sentence because of where he comes from than the first one. So why in the world would I want to remind God where I come from? Ribbono shel Olam, I did all these sins, but have mercy on me because I come from Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Why doesn't God turn around and say, "Yeah, look at you. You come from these great people and look at you." I would rather tell the Ribbono shel Olam, you know what I have in my past? Achav, Menashe, right? All these grand villains, and not so bad compared to them. Why in the world do we even mention our avos when I would rather hide the fact that I come from such great stock? The answer is what it means to evoke zechus avos, bris avos, is saying the following. Ribbono shel Olam, yes, I did not act properly. I did a lot of terrible things. But it's worth it to give me another chance because I have tremendous potential. Why? Because I had avos like Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Velea, and their potential is within me. I may not have utilized and realized that potential until now. But Ribbono shel Olam, if you give me another chance, it's worth it because I have that potential and I can produce tremendous things. So it's worth giving me another chance. Because if I would have no potential and I'm good for nothing, and my past is no good, then why give me credit for the future? Punishment. But if I show the Ribbono shel Olam, look what I have within me. I have the potential of the avos and imos. So give me another chance. It's worth another chance. That's what we are evoking. We're not evoking protectia because they were great. That somehow makes it that now the Ribbono shel Olam is going to have mercy on me. Why? But because they exist within me. And I have the potential to be like them. So I may not have realized that potential in the past, but I ask the Ribbono shel Olam to give me another chance, because there is a potential for the future. That is the concept of avos and imahos, and it has a tremendous relevance again to Elul, to Aseres Yemei Tshuva, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and so on. Now I want to speak specifically about the midos of Rachel Imenu, which we have within us, and this also is very relevant to Chodesh Elul. We find in Chazal three major points about Rachel Imenu that show what her major character milas are, major attributes. First thing Chazal say is the tznius, the modesty of Rachel Imenu. When it came to exposing her father's plot to exchange her sister for her on her wedding day, Rachel Imenu did not go public, not embarrass her father, not embarrass her sister. She kept everything quiet, modest, hidden. Rachel Imenu had the power to be a modest person, modesty. And because of that, it says, because of the tznius that Rachel had, one of her descendants who came from Binyamin, who was Shaul HaMelech, was also a very modest person. And when he was told he was going to be the king, and he had to report what happened at that meeting, where he was told about the donkeys that he lost and about his fact he should be king, he mentioned the donkeys. He just conveniently forgot to mention the fact that they told him he was going to be king. A very modest person. And
the...
What?
So
right. And because of that, what's it called? Mordechai also came from them. Okay. In any case, the second midah of what's it called, of Rachel Imenu, is the fact that she was willing to yield to her sister. And she gave her sister the simonim. Rachel and Yaakov knew that Lavan could do anything. And there was a chance that he would deceive Yaakov and give him the wrong woman. So they made up a code between them that Yaakov would know that it's Rachel. And Rachel realized that her sister was being replaced. She didn't publicly denounce her father. She kept everything quiet. But she also didn't want her sister to be embarrassed. She didn't want her sister to be insulted. So she revealed to her the code so Yaakov wouldn't know that it's not her, to save her sister that embarrassment. So we find Rachel Imenu's second midah tova was the fact that she gave her sister the code. She was very much concerned about the feelings of her sister. And the third thing was the power of her tears. Rachel Imenu cries for her children. Rachel mevaka al boneho me'ono lehinochem. And the Rabban Hashem says, Mini kolech mibechi, Rachel Imenu, stop crying. Yesh tikvah lachriseich, there's hope. Because of your crying, v'shavu banim l'gvulam. And it says, the bechi yavo. Klal Yisrael will come back to Eretz Yisrael, the bechi in the schus of the mother who's crying, the schus of Rachel Imenu. So those are the three things. And I want to say that there's a tremendous connection between the three. The tznius, the ability to feel for her sister's embarrassment, that her sister shouldn't be embarrassed, and to be willing to give up her husband for that, and her crying. Let's start with the concept of tznius. Most people think that tznius is that the body is something erotic, right, not nice, and therefore you have to cover it up. And that's what tznius is, covering up a body which is not a nice thing. But that's absurd, because the body is a creation of the Ribono Shel Olam. There's nothing not nice about the body. In addition, if we have to cover up the bodies of human beings because they're not nice, then it would be certainly necessary to cover the bodies of animals. which are probably even less nice. Till today, haven't checked yet this morning, but nobody has come up with a chumrah to only go to the zoo if the animals are clothed. In fact, the only place in the world that I know that they clothe their animals is in Los Angeles. Their dogs and cats go clothed, but that's because they themselves don't go clothed. So they have to do something with the clothing. So what is tznius? Before the sin of Adam and Chava, there was no need for the kind of tznius that we refer to by covering the body. Because before the chait of Adam and Chava, it was clear that a human being was a neshama. That's what we are. We are not bodies with little Casper the Friendly Ghost flitting around inside of us called a neshama. It's not how you're supposed to look at yourself. We are neshamas. We are neshamas who existed as neshamas for thousands of years from the time we were created till we came into this world. And in a spiritual world, as neshamas, we could function very nicely. We could see without eyes and hear without ears and get around without arms and legs. However, when we came into this physical world, we needed a spacesuit to wear to be able to function, just like an astronaut. As long as he's on terra firma, he's on the earth, he can function very nicely without any special suit or apparatus. But once he goes into outer space, where there is no oxygen, there is no air pressure, there are no sound waves, so he needs to wear a pressurized suit, he needs to breathe through an oxygen apparatus, and he needs to speak through a radio, because there's no sound waves. When he comes back to Earth, he takes off the suit. Doesn't need it anymore. Can function very nicely without it. We, as neshamas, were able to function in a spiritual world without any extra apparatus. The neshama itself could function very nicely there. But once our neshamas came into this physical world, we needed a spacesuit to wear, an inner spacesuit. We need eyes to see and ears to hear and arms and legs to get around and a brain with which to think, because the neshama in a physical world can't function unless it has a physical body to function through. But we are not the body. The body is a suit of clothing that the neshama wears in this physical world. And therefore, when we go back to the spiritual world, we leave this world, we leave the body here. Just like this, the astronaut takes off this spacesuit. And it could be that's one of the reasons why the way that we express mourning when somebody dies is by tearing our clothing. Because it shows it's only the clothing that's been torn away. But the essence of the person still exists. In any case, so before the sin of Adam and Chava, it was clear that a human being is a neshama. And the body is merely a suit of clothing that the neshama wears to be able to function in this physical world. But once Adam and Chava sinned, which wasn't too far into the existence of this world, and they used their bodies in contradiction to the neshama, they used their bodies against their neshama, so they were bogdim, they were traitors. And therefore, the body was a traitor. It rebelled against the neshama. It did something that wasn't good for the neshama. It wasn't that the body now was just a means of the neshama being able to function. Because the body now did something that was counterproductive to the neshama. It sinned. So the body was a bogeid, was a traitor. And therefore, you needed a beged. You needed a garment to cover the body. And the garment basically makes the following statement. Don't be distracted by my body, by my physical being, and think that's what I am. There's more here than meets the eye. That's what I am. The neshama is the main thing. My body is a secondary thing. And that is what tznius is. Wherever there is an inner spiritual value, and you could be distracted by the external. You see the body. Maybe that's the main thing. Maybe there is no neshama. All you see is a body. So you cover the body and make the statement, there's more here than meets the eye. Don't be distracted by what you can see externally, because that's not what is the main thing. The main thing is what's beneath the surface, what you can't see. That's my neshama. And therefore, wherever there is a deep, inner, spiritual value, and you could be distracted by the externals, that's where you cover the externals to distract attention from them and to emphasize the fact there's more here than meets the eye. I'll give you one example. It has nothing to do with human beings, nothing to do with bodies. It says when the Mishkan was finished, it said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Kan Yofa HaTznius. Tznius is very fitting to the Mishkan. And therefore the Mishkan, the gold, the silver, was covered with coverings. Just like a bride. It had a veil in the front and a train in the back. Mamish like a bride. Modest. Now what in the world does covering the walls of the Mishkan have to do with modesty? The Mishkan's not erotic. Nothing wrong with it. It's a beautiful building. Why cover it? The answer can be illustrated with the following. Some of the grandchildren of Rav Sholom Shvadron were at the Kosel HaMaravi on a Shabbos. And they see an Israeli with one of those cardboard yarmulkes on writing a kvittel on Shabbos and putting it in the wall. So they ran over to him and they assumed that maybe he has somebody sick, deathly ill, and he thinks that writing a kvittel is pikuach nefesh, you're allowed to do it on Shabbos to save a life. So he went to him and said, what are you doing? What are you writing here at Shabbos? He said, I'm the captain of an Israeli soccer team, and we have a championship match coming up this week, and I put in a request to the wall that we win. Now, if that's how you look at the Mikdash, at the Kosel, whatever it may be, it borders on Avodah Zarah. There is no difference between mirror, mirror on the wall or wall, wall on the floor. It's all the same. If you think that the wall answers requests and all you have to do is put your request in the wall and the wall will answer you, there's no difference between a wall or a golden building and a golden calf. It's all the same. So what is the idea of the Kosel HaMaravi? It is the last remnant of the Mikdash, where the Shechina never left. And the purpose of the Mikdash and the Mishkan is not the beautiful walls, it's not the building. There's no difference between a golden building and a golden calf. It's the Shechina that permeates that building. So therefore you could be distracted by the gold and the silver of the Mishkan and think that this is a holy building. So we cover the externals to make the statement, what is here is the main thing is what you can't see, not what you can see. Don't be distracted by the externals and realize what is the main thing over here is what's inside, is the Shechina. And everything, wherever there is an inner value, and you could be distracted by the externals, we cover the externals, that's called tznius. The word lehatznia is the title of a chapter in Maseches Shabbos, the Gemara in Shabbos. And it's oversimplified, but for our purpose, it's good enough. What's the concept of Hamatznia? That's the name of the perek, Hamatznia. You know that in order to be liable to a earthly punishment on Shabbos, in other words, to get a death penalty, or to get, what's it called, to have to bring a sacrifice if you did it unintentionally, it's not enough just to do the malacha. You have to do it in an important way. There has to be a shear, a certain amount, right? Just like on Yom Kippur. You have, in order to be chayiv, right, to be liable for the full punishment of eating on Yom Kippur, you have to eat a certain amount. If you eat less than that amount, it's asur. You're not allowed to do it, but you don't get that full punishment. So it's too on Shabbos, carrying on Shabbos. If you carry a little crumb, you're not allowed to do that, but you won't get a death penalty for that. But if you carry in food items, a kezias, that's important enough that if you do that on purpose and you're warned, you'll get a death penalty. Less than a kezias, you're not allowed to do it, but you won't get a death penalty for it. However, there's a concept of hamatznia. Let's say a person has a few crumbs left from their wedding cake, and they keep it in a little jewelry box, right, in their drawer for safekeeping, and every once in a while they open it up and look at those few crumbs and remember, right, how delicious the cake was at their wedding, or how nice the wedding was or whatever. And on Shabbos they forget, and they carry out those few crumbs. So then, even though normally you wouldn't be liable to a punishment with less than a kazayas, but here is something you put away for safekeeping, you made those crumbs important. And carrying those crumbs also would incur a punishment. That's the concept of a matznia. What do you see from that? That matznia is not to hide something away because it's not good. It's to hide something away because it's important. We don't hide the body because there's something wrong with the body. We hide the body to emphasize that the body is a suit of clothing to a neshama, which makes the body more important. But if you only see the body as a body, then you're an animal. So basically, when a person is tsanua and covers their body properly, they're making the following statement. Don't be distracted by my body, by my externals. I am not an animal. There's more to me than meets the eye. And that's why animals don't have to cover their bodies. We don't have to cover the bodies of animals, because there's nothing internal. All there is, what you see is what you get. So therefore there's nothing to cover. Nothing wrong with the body. But if you're going to think that the body is the main thing, or that's all there is, and forget about the neshama, then the body is a distracting, negative thing. That's the idea. Based on that, once you make that statement, so we wear clothing that make the body look nice. It covers the body, but it is not, it's form-fitting to a certain degree. If the idea of tznius would be to cover the body so you wouldn't know we have a body, then you should walk in a tent. Everybody should wear tents. We should all dress up like Arab women or whatever, so you don't know that there is a body, bichlal. Now, it's just two eyes walking in the street. Why don't we dress like that? I'm sure there are people who do, but in any case, why isn't that the halacha? The answer is that once you make the statement that the body is not the ikkar, the body's not the main thing, but the body is a suit of clothing that the neshama wears, now the body is also important. The Vilna Gaon explains the pasuk, Sheker hachein vehevel hayofi, isha yiras Hashem itisalo, that when is physical beauty vain and charm false, when there's nothing more than that. But isha yiras Hashem, and a woman who fears God, he tisalo, she should be praised for her beauty and her charm. Then the beauty and the charm reflect that inner neshama. You distract attention from the body, not to think that that's all there is. But once you know that there's more, the body itself reflects that beauty. That's why it says that Sarah Imenu was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. On the surface, that seems difficult because a 20-year-old is more pretty than a 7-year-old. So what does it mean she was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7? And the Torah went out of its way to tell us when she died, she was Meya Shana, the Esrim Shana, the Sheva Shana, to tell us how beautiful she was at 20. Who cares? She was Sarah Imenu. Made a difference if she was beautiful, not beautiful. What difference did it make? Obviously, the Torah considers it different, considers it important. Rachel Imenu was Yafei Toar, the Yafei Mareh. Torah goes out of its way to tell us she was beautiful. Who cares? She was Rachel Imenu. Now, the answer is that the beauty we're talking about is the following beauty. Beauty is a very subjective thing. It's in the eyes of the beholder. Everybody sees something that they consider beautiful, but somebody else considers ugly, and vice versa. Okay? An example, which I always love to give. The Ubangi tribe in deepest Africa have a quaint custom. You'll be very happy that you were not brought up amongst the Ubangis. They take their daughters when they're little, and they put a half saucer in their mouth between their upper gum and their lip to stretch their upper lip. And as the lip stretches, they put in a bigger saucer and a bigger saucer until the time that the girl is about 15, 16 years old, and she's of marriageable age, her upper lip sticks out about a foot. Now, if you don't have an upper lip that sticks out a foot amongst the Ubangis, you'll never find a shidduch. On the other hand, right, in our circles, if you have a daughter who has an upper lip that sticks out a foot, you're going to send her to the orthodontist, spend thousands of dollars because she'll never find the shidduch if you don't fix her upper lip, right, that sticks out a foot. Right, I had a daughter who needed orthodonture work. I was thinking of sending her to the Ubangis. It would have been much cheaper. But the shidduchim over there were a little too black for me. In any case, I couldn't resist that. So what's beautiful? It says Esther Amalka was no se schein be'ene koroeh. Everybody thought she was beautiful. How could that be? Either she had a lip that stuck out a foot and the Ubangis thought she was exotic, or she didn't have a lip that stuck out a foot and the Americans thought she was pretty, but the Ubangis didn't think she was pretty. How could everybody think she's pretty? The answer is there is a certain beauty that is universal, that is not the external subjective beauty. That's the beauty of a 7-year-old. It's the innocence of youth. It's something that represents the inner beauty externally. That's what Sari Menu had. She was as beautiful at 20 as she was at 7. Meaning that her beauty was that inner beauty of the neshama that shone outside. It's a certain chain that a person has where you can see their inner spiritual beauty represented externally. That's what real tznius is. Where a person dresses tastefully, where their external image reflects what their internal holiness is. When you look at the person, you say, wow, that's a special person, that's a holy person. I could see the innocence, the beauty of that spirituality represented physically, externally. That's what real tznius is. In any case, so that is the concept of tznius, and that's the concept of busha. The concept of being able to be embarrassed, ashamed. In the world we live in today, shame is a sickness. That you go to a psychiatrist to have him heal it, so you shouldn't be ashamed. You shouldn't have any inhibitions. Right? Shame is looked upon as a negative thing. Heard the story of a person, a very respectable elderly person who was a respectable businessman. He was a kleptomaniac. He couldn't control himself. He was constantly shoplifting, stealing, and he was always caught. And it was a terrible embarrassment. What's it called? He was caught. His family had to come bail him out of jail. Right? Respectable businessman, rich man, didn't need these things that he stole. He just had this urge to steal. So he'd walk into a store, walk out with pens in his pocket or whatever, and he would be caught. Terrible, terrible shame and embarrassment. So one day he goes to his friend, he says, thank God I went to a psychiatrist and now I'm cured. He said, they cured you, you don't steal anymore? He said, no, but I don't feel embarrassed anymore. That's the world we live in. So shame, but shame is a very positive thing. It could be taken to an extreme, which is not good. Anything can be taken to an extreme. But normal shame is where a person understands that there are things that are not proper for him to do. That are not proper for a human being to do, for a Jew to do. And he's ashamed and therefore holds those things in. Doesn't bring them out or whatever. That's boshes panim. The panim on your face, you can see everything. It's the screen through which you see what's inside a person, and therefore there's a safety. The face turns red. It's a safety thing that not everything has to be brought to the surface. There's certain things that should be kept inside. That's the idea of busha. That's the idea of tznius. So that's what's it called, that's the first midah of Rachel Imenu. Now that has a tremendously close connection to the second midah. What was the second midah? That she felt her sister's embarrassment She felt her sister's pain and therefore was willing to yield to her that she shouldn't be pained. How does that work?
Very complicated, because if she felt the sister's pain, she didn't feel her husband's pain.
She felt, it's a good question, she felt that if the Ribbono Shel Olam let her father be successful, then she wasn't supposed to be the wife of Yaakov Avinu, and Yaakov Avinu would understand that that was Ratzon Hashem. But it shouldn't happen in a way that will hurt her sister to begin with, because Yaakov Avinu on the surface, if he didn't have time to think about it, would react perhaps impetuously or without thinking. But she knew that if Yaakov had time to think it over, like she did, that he'd come to the same conclusion. So it wasn't a question of hurting Yaakov, it was a question of saving her sister from an embarrassment of the moment. Yaakov Avinu would have time later to think about it, would be okay. But on the moment, she wanted to save her sister from that embarrassment. In any case, what's the connection? We are commanded to be self-concerned. Person has to be concerned about himself. He has to worry about himself. You come first. If you lose something and somebody else loses something, you can only find one of them. Look for one of them. You have to look for your own. If you have a canteen of water, and if you drink it, you'll live. If you share it with somebody else or give it to them, either neither of you will live, or he'll live and you not. You come first. It's your water. Drink it. You need tzedakah, somebody else needs tzedakah. You only have enough money for one, goes to you. So self-concern is a Torah mandate, but you can't only be concerned about yourself. You have to be concerned about others. So how do we deal with this conflict of self-concern and concern for others? Says Rav Shimon Shkop that somebody who considers himself from his toes to his head has a big problem. Self-concern is me, and all those people out there that I have to be concerned about is a conflict. But some people are bigger than that. And they consider themselves and their spouse. They consider their spouse part of them. Ishto kigufo, bal ki ishto. So when they're concerned about their spouse, they're not concerned about somebody else, they're concerned about themselves. So that's also self-concern. Some people are bigger than that. They consider their children part of them. So when they're concerned about their children, they're concerned about themselves. Now themselves is a lot of bodies. Some people realize all their extended family is themselves. So there's a lot of people who are myself. Some people extend that to their neighborhood, their city, their country, to Klal Yisrael, to the world. So if a person really feels one with everybody, then it's all self-concern. The only question is, which part of me right now takes priority? But it's not me or them, it's all me. That makes the idea much, much easier. That was godless. That's being a great person. Moshe Rabbeinu. When was he considered a godl? Vayigdal Moshe, vayetze alecho vayar besivlosam. When he went out to his brothers and felt their pain. Nosan eino velibo, intellectually, he gave his eyes and his heart, emotionally, to feel what they were feeling. That's a great person. Who can mamish feel one with somebody else. Now how do you do that? Physically, we're all different. We're all different bodies. It's spiritually that we are one. So in order for a person to be able to mamish feel the pain or the simcha of someone else, they have to emphasize their spiritual side, not their physical side. Because physically we're separated. Spiritually we're one. That was Rachel Imenu. Since Rachel Imenu had that concept of tznius, and she emphasized the inner spiritual value of what she was, she was able, mamish, to feel her sister's pain as if it was hers. So she wasn't saving her sister, she was saving herself from that embarrassment. It's my embarrassment, it's not my sister's embarrassment. That was the Maila. And the Maila, Bechi, tears of such a person are very, very valuable. Because where do tears come from? From within the person. I don't remember who said it, Emerson, somebody, that tears are the sweat of the soul. Yeah, some famous author. No? Sarah, you know who it is? In any case, I think it's Emerson. So the tears are the sweat of the soul. And, which is true. Bechi comes from the word becha, from within. Bechi in gematria is lave, is the heart. Tears have a tremendous effect. Even our enemies know that, what a Jewish tear can do. Nebuchadnezzar HaRasha, when he exiled us, he sent his Sar Tzava, his chief officer, Nebuzradan, and he told him, do not let the Jewish people rest until you cross the Euphrates River and you're out of Eretz Israel. Do not let them rest. Why? Because I'm afraid they'll rest, they'll start crying, and if they cry, we're finished. We have no power over them. So don't let them rest, don't let them cry until they cross the Euphrates River. And that's what he did. He kept them moving and moving, didn't have time even to cry. And once they crossed the Euphrates River, he let them rest. And that's what it says, Al Naros Bavel Shom Yoshavnu. That's where we were able to sit. And Gam Bachinu, then we started to cry. And at that time, Yirmiyahu HaNavi caught up with them, and he found them sitting by Naros Bavel crying. And he said to them, Meyed ani aleichem shamayim va'aretz, I testify, I bring to testimony the heavens and the earth, that had you cried one tear while you still were in Eretz Israel, you wouldn't have been exiled. Now's too late. So that is the koach, that's the power of tears. It represents that inner power. So a person who is tzanua, who is modest, who accentuates the inner part of them, is the same person who can feel the tsaris of others, is the same person whose tears have tremendous, tremendous power. And that's what the Rabban Shalom said. Rachel Imenu said to the Rabban Shalom, what are you so upset with the Jewish people that they exchanged you for an idol? I'm a human being. My father exchanged my sister for me, and I didn't get so upset. So you should be upset because of an idol? And the Rabban Shalom tells her, stop crying. The crying, which is it? The crying or this argument? But the idea is that Rachel Imenu said, I was able to forego my husband because I didn't want my sister to be hurt. Why? Because it's my hurt, not her hurt. I feel it as much as her. So it wasn't that I was giving up something for her. I felt what she felt. So Rabbanu Shalom, if you forgive the Jewish people, it's not going to look like there's no reward and no punishment and the world is a hefkervel. People will understand that if I could feel for my sister like it was me, then you can feel for the Jewish people like it's you. And if you forgive us, it's because it's a pain to you, Rabbanu Shalom, just like it was a pain to me. And somebody who cries for the Jewish people, who has that kind of feeling, those tears are real tears. And those tears have a tremendous effect. And that's what the Rabban Shalom told Rachel Imenu, Mini kolech mibechi, your tears have had their effect, you don't have to cry anymore, v'shavu banim l'gvulam, yesh tikva l'achriseich, there's hope, and Klal Yisrael return to Eretz Israel, and partially in the schus of those tears, but those tears represent the fact that a person feels their inner spiritual being as being the main thing, and then being able to feel what every other Jew for all generations feels, to feel one with them, then those tears are extremely effective and tears that have a tremendous, tremendous benefit and effect. And that is in Mirtz Hashem. Elul is a time for crying, right? This week said we have the crying of the captive woman for 30 days and the Arizal says a hint, the Zohar says a hint to Elul, and we are going to evoke the schus of our avos and imahos during this month, and this is the month to really feel not only as alone, but the best way to be zochet badin is to be somebody who has a connection to all Jews, not to be judged as an individual, but to be judged as part of the cloud, and all of these things are relevant and significant to what our avodah of Elul and Yom Noraim is going to be.
That Rachel Imenu died when she was 36 years old. The number 36 hints to the Lamed Vav Tzadikim Nistarim, the hidden Tzadikim in the generation, but even more so, the light that God created in the beginning of creation that was put away for the tzaddikim, the light that was a spiritual light which was hidden in the Torah, existed for 36 hours. 12 hours on Friday and 24 hours on Shabbos, and then Motzi Shabbos it was put away, and the Rabbanu Shlomo instructed Adam HaRishon how to make fire. And that's why the Hanukkah candles are a total of 36. If you add 1 plus 2 plus 3 all the way to 8 is equal 36. So that's why Rachel Imenu died at 36, represented this fact that she was that inner spiritual light, inner spiritual force. Whereas Leah, the numerical value of the name Leah, Lamed Aleph Hey, is 36. Rachel was more the hidden, she died at 36, and Leah was more the open representation. Leah brought the majority of tribes into the world, and Rachel brought only two, but she brought the ones that would prepare all the other tribes and be the ultimate place, Binyamin, where the Shechinah would reside.